This is Fresh Air. John Turturro made his screen debut in Raging Bull. You won't remember him from that. He had only one line. Now when Turturro is in a film, he has a big part, and you notice him. He's been in 3 Spike Lee films. In Do the Right Thing, he played the racist son of the pizzeria owner. The Coen brothers wrote parts for him in 2 films, including the leading role in Barton Fink. Turturro co-wrote, directed, and stars in the film Mac, an homage to his father, a first-generation Italian-American who was a carpenter. During part of the 50s, he had his own contracting business in Queens. John started working as a helper for his father during summers and vacations from the age of 10. In the film, Turturro plays the part based on his father. I spoke with Turturro last winter when Mac was released and asked him what parts of his father's personality he wanted to get across.
Well, certainly his pursuit of his craft and perfection in his work as a builder. Also, I always thought of him somewhat in the classical vein.
What do you mean?
I mean, I always saw him when I was on a job as sort of a modern-day equivalent of King Lear, you know, raging at the sky and all the problems that he would be going through. He was sort of a larger-than-life figure physically and vocally, emotionally. He was a very passionate person.
You started writing Mac in 1980.
Yes.
Was writing this, in a way, an effort to understand your father?
Well, it's a way to understand the world that you're from. You know, if you come from a world like I come from, you don't really see that represented on screen. So it was a way to explore the world I was from, maybe understand my father. But I always thought of my father as, even though he was very individual, as indicative of many men that I met in that field, because it's a visceral world. At the same time, it's full of humor and directness, and people are in touch with themselves physically, mentally, and emotionally. You don't have the restraints of an office when you're on a ladder helping somebody up to go on a roof. It cuts through many, many barriers.
Why did you write this movie from the perspective of your father as opposed to writing it from the perspective of you, his son?
I'm not that interested. You know, my perspective, it allowed me to be able to be removed from it, to look at an experience that was before my time, in a sense, that helped shape me and give me the opportunity that I have. I was interested not in doing my relationship with my father was very complete. We had a very intimate and well-rounded relationship. We battled, we were honest, we got along. There wasn't much, that we didn't say to each other. But in his world, there were a lot of things that were unexpressed. And I just thought, it's a world that I've never seen. And I thought that he was a very interesting person, and certainly from other people's reactions, I wanted to talk about his experience in his time with his brothers and his family, which is a much more difficult time than the life that I've had to grow up around.
During or right after the closed credits, there's a recording from an answering machine that plays, and I think it's probably your father. It's just going, John, John, pick up the phone. John, are you there?
Right.
Is that your father?
That's my father.
On your answering machine?
That's right. And then he eventually, he keeps thinking, I'm going to appear. And I never do. And then he keeps talking as though I'm going to, come on. And then he starts cursing and explaining to the guy on the job that he's talking to his son. And sometimes I pick up and sometimes I don't. And it was something that I had kept. And it seemed very appropriate. My partner, Brandon Cole, encouraged me to use it because we thought it was humorous. And it's, there's a lot of his spirit in the film. So it's sort of, I guess, the right way to end it.
Why did you end up keeping that tape?
I was rolling on the ground when I heard it. I just thought it was hilarious. I thought my father was hilarious, and he never even knew it. I kept saying, yelling into the machine, John, are you there? John, John. And then you'd hear him getting really angry. And he was just so unconscious about his behavior, and it was very childlike in many ways. And that was a great thing. He just didn't monitor himself. And when you see that, it can be exhausting sometimes to be around, but other times it can be really exhilarating.
Your father seems like he was very commanding, pushy when necessary. He ran his own business for a while, so he had a...
Lee J. Cobbish.
Very good.
Yes.
Were you ever embarrassed at how forward your father was watching him work?
Oh, are you kidding? My father saw... I'll tell you a quick story. My father saw a film, To Live and Die in L.A., that I was in.
Yeah.
And I went. I took him to see the premiere. And he, when I was running in the scene through the airport, and Bill Peterson was running after me, my father shouted out to the screen in front of all these celebrities, "Go, John, go! You know, they can't catch John." Andy Warhol was there, all these people, like totally having the time of his life. And I was hitting him. I was telling him, "Dad, be quiet." He was having, he looked at me like I was crazy. And, you know, in retrospect, he was right. That was the proper response to a film like that. he was the perfect audience for it, and he was having a good time. So, you know, he wasn't intimidated by all these, like, pretentious people around him. I remember when he met Andy Warhol afterwards, he didn't know who he was. And right in his presence, he said, "Who's the guy with the white hair?"
Well, that must have made you feel real good at the time.
Oh, I was embarrassed. But later on, you know, you really think about, well, why was I embarrassed and stuff like that?
In Miller's Crossing, you played a bookie, Bernie the Schmata Birnbaum.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great scene in which the character played by Gabriel Byrne is taking you into the woods to execute you. And you're basically begging for your life. And you're kind of, you know, whining and begging. And it's really, it's a fantastic scene. Would you describe that scene for us and tell us, like, what you came prepared to do, like how you prepared for that?
Well, I can't describe what I did because I really don't know what I did. I'll tell you the truth. You know, after you do all your preparation, you throw it away. I've had a couple situations where people have, you know, by accident pulled out, once I had someone pull out a gun on me when I was a young kid, and I remembered that, but I never had that situation exactly happen to me. But I've seen weapons, and I know that it can be a very scary thing. I just tried to put myself in the situation and use everything within my means to survive and believe in that situation as best I could. And I didn't monitor myself at all. It's actually a little strange to watch because it's very well put together and scored and everything also. That's why it's so effective. But it's, you know, you would hope to reveal something. I like to be able to do that if I can. And I think I did in that scene a little bit. But I can't explain to you that I was thinking exact. I do all my work and then I try to just, I hope it's there.
Tommy, you can't do this. You don't bump guys. You're not like those animals back there. It's not right, Tom. They can't make us do this. It's the wrong situation. They can't make us different people than we are. We're not muscle, Tom. I never killed anybody. I used a little information for a chisel, that's all. It's my nature, Tom. I can't help it. Somebody hands me an angle, I play it. I don't deserve to die for that. Do you think I do? I'm just a grifter, huh, Tom? I'm a nobody. But I'll tell you what, I never... crossed a friend, huh, Tom? I never killed anybody, never crossed a friend. No, you will bet. We're not like those animals. This is not us. This is a half dream. It's a dream, Tommy. I'm praying to you. I can't die. I can't die. Out here in the woods. Like a dumb animal. In the woods, like a dumb animal. Like a dumb animal. I can't die out here in the woods. Like a dumb animal. I can't die.
In your new movie, you tried to really understand the lives of your mother and father. But in an earlier movie, Five Corners, in which you played a kind of psycho type of guy who kidnaps a character played by Jodie Foster, you threw your mother in that movie out the window.
Right, but I didn't write that. John Patrick Shanley
right.
wrote that.
Now, did you have to explain that to your mother? Mom, I did not write this movie?
Yeah, well, my mother was... I remember seeing it with my mother and father. It was the last film my father saw me in. He was quite ill. And my mother was just, you know, flipped out when she saw it. And my father, like, thought it was really funny. So my mother was crying and my father was laughing. He couldn't believe how bad I was. And that was a great scene, writing-wise, I think, because John tapped into a very simple thing. a parent and a child, and the parent has never listened to the child, and the child is desperately wanting to be heard. And once the child is heard, then of course he took a dramatic liberty and said, okay, well, let's end this relationship on a good note, you know. But that's why that scene was powerful. You know, people talk about the end result. That was a great scene.
You've made several movies with Spike Lee.
Mm-hmm.
In Do the Right Thing, you played the racist son of the owner of the pizzeria.
Yes.
Did you have your choice of which son you got to play?
Yes. Yes. And I chose to play the racist because I am a racist. No,
I'm kidding. Oh, I knew that.
and Spike knew that. No, he had asked me what I wanted, you know, interested in. And he wanted Richard Edson to play a role. And I had read it, and I just thought that the more interesting part was the guy who was, he said, you know, maybe you want to go against, you would probably play this, the part I wound up playing, maybe you want to play the other part. And we looked at it and stuff, but I thought that was the more important role in that film. And he certainly was expressing a lot of sentiments that were important to the film. And I thought I could make him human. And that's what I tried to do.
In Spike Lee's movie, Mo' Better Blues, about jazz musicians, you and your brother Nicholas played the Flatbush brothers, two mm-hmm. kind of greedy Jewish club owners. Mm-hmm. A lot of people criticized your portrayal as being too broad and anti-Semitic. Did something get out of control in that?
I think it was maybe too broad, personally. Half of what we did was cut out of the film. We almost designed it as a running vaudeville type of gag, but Spike cut a lot of scenes because other scenes didn't work, and I think some of the humor was lost. It's almost like we're in a different film a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the response was warranted. I think it was really over-exaggerated. I don't even know how effectual we are in the course of the film, and we're certainly, if we wanted to make an issue out of it, really an issue, you know that he would have, and it just wasn't warranted. I just think that no one came out saying, boy, I have such strong anti-Semitic views. And matter of fact, you know, we had even discussed changing the names of the characters at one time. And we were saying, well, would it be insulting? Would it not? But then when all those other scenes are in there, we thought, well, it could almost be, we could almost make these characters to be like Crazy Eddie, to be almost ridiculous. I don't think it worked that way. People needed to write something. Because it's Spike, they wrote it. And that's really, I saw the film, I said, it's not that effective to warrant that response.
In most of your movies, you've played either Italian or Jewish characters.
I've played other characters. I have.
Right. But well, most of them have.
Some, no? That you Some. Know of.
Okay. Some. right.
Yes. I've played heavy characters, too, on stage.
Right, right.
Yes.
You have what might be described as ethnic features, facially?
I'm dark.
Mm-hmm.
I have dark hair, I have a prominent nose, and I am from another country, and they came to here, but I'm as American as a lot of other people.
Do you feel that you have been held back from certain leading man type roles because you don't have like the perfect Hollywood type of version of handsome?
Well, you know, you can look at it both ways. I'm sure there are guys who are gorgeous who wish they could do some of the roles that I do. Do you know what I mean? So
mm-hmm.
no one's totally... An actor is blessed and burdened with their face and their body. I think I am a versatile actor. I certainly played a huge gamut on stage from Greek to Spanish to Italian to Jewish to English. And I think I can do that in the films. I may not play a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant because I probably won't be cast that way. But I certainly can play the lead in a film or a small role in a film. The thing is, there are many stories to tell. If a person's, you take the Jewish experience, there are millions of stories to tell. Or the black experience. Just because a guy's a black actor doesn't mean he can't play someone articulate, someone who's ignorant, someone who's ambitious. There are many different stories to tell. Unfortunately, in films, they usually tell the same story when it comes to certain ethnic groups over and over and over again. And if you are from an ethnic background or minority, you realize that from the scripts that are offered to you. I've tried to do intelligent scripts and ones that would be entertaining too.
Mm-hmm.
And that wouldn't be an insult to the people that I know.
My guess is actor John Turturro. He was in Do the Right Thing, Miller's Crossing, and Barton Fink. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Actor John Turturro is my guest. You grew up in Queens. What got you interested in acting when you were young?
Well, when you don't have a lot of money, you know, you see a film like The Sea Wolf with Edward G. Robinson or something with Burt Lancaster, and, you know, you travel, you go somewhere. And that was a means of escape. And my whole family were film lovers. We all watched films and became very involved in them. And I, you know, from James Cagney, you know, to Kirk Douglas, to Marlon Brando, and they had a big impression on me. And I loved athletics also. Maybe if I would have been a better athlete, that would have been something I would have loved to do also.
When you were young, you used to keep a scrapbook of your favorite actors?
Yeah. I had ratings, reviews. I was ahead of Siskel and Ebert. I told it to Roger Ebert. I said, "This your show," when I first saw it, was like, you know, my kitchen table. We used to discuss films like that all the time and have big arguments and say, you know, Burt is a much better actor than Kirk, or Kirk is better than Burt in this film. You know, well, what about Anthony Quinn? Oh, you know. So, yeah, I would rate all the actors and review it. And, well, actually, I had an injury one year, and that made me sort of, I watched tons and tons of films. I broke my leg severely, and I did a lot of my scrapbooks then.
So, you grew up in New York City. So did you watch Million Dollar Movie, which had continuous showings of the same film all week?
Loved Million Dollar Movie. It was a study guide, basically, for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because the film, if you liked it, you could watch it 5 times.
Right. Now, the films I saw the most in Million Dollar Movie included The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Fantastic.
Fantastic.
Charles Laughton, one of my favorites.
Yeah. King Kong and Mighty Joe Young.
All right. You're right up there. Right up there. These are all, you know, Five Corners was a homage, in a sense, to King Kong. I mean, yes. You know,
you think
Shandling.
So?
Oh, yes. I was basically playing the human version of King Kong. John Shandling, I'll tell you that, with a little bit of Frankenstein thrown in.
Oh, that's great.
Mighty Joe Young. You're talking about, you know, things close to my heart. Close to my heart.
So when you were really getting involved with watching movies on television, keeping your scrapbook, did you try to act around the house? Did you do impressions?
I used to do impressions, yes. And I did it with my cousin Ralph, who did all the paintings in the movie and the storyboards for me. We used to do a little act together. But yeah, I used to do lots of impressions.
Of who?
Bert, Kirk, Marlon, Rod Steiger. You know, matter of fact, one time we performed at a club, and instead of doing, like, you know, just funny sort of skits with humor, we started doing, like, serious scenes from On the Waterfront. Someone threw a bottle at us. It was in high school. And I was so shaken up. I was like, come on, you know, I was like, what are you doing? Yeah. But it was a way of, like, you know, it was your first impulse towards acting.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah.
So what was the Burt Lancaster scenes that you would do?
Oh, you know, from, you know, you name it, Brute Force, Elma Gantry, Jim Thorpe, that was a big one.
And Kirk Douglas?
Kirk Douglas, you know, Spartacus was big, but all his movies, Champion. You know, Kirk, he's my, you know, he was like one of my men. And Burt is like, well, that's why Burt's in the film. You know, Burt was like... You know, he had to be in the film, basically. Because Bert was like an extended member of our family. We would talk about Bert as if he was like an uncle, you know. Because we loved Bert. You know, my father loved him.
So can you still do impressions of these guys?
I can still do Bert, that's right.
Would you?
Would I do Bert? I was just, you know. You have to give me some lines. Well, from Sydney. Sydney, you're a cookie full of arsenic. I'd hate to take a bite out of you.
Oh, that's great.
Well, you have to see me do the whole with the hands and everything.
No, that's from the movie where they're a gossip columnist.
Oh,
What's it called?
Sweet Smell of Success.
Yeah, Clifford Odette's screenplay. Yeah,
Sydney,
yeah.
You live in moral twilight. Yeah, I love him. He's fantastic.
So yeah. Who would do Tony Curtis to your...
Tony Curtis? You know, Tony was a big one, too.
So your friend
sometimes
would do
my
Tony?
Cousin Ralph would do it, but my brother Nicholas would do it. You know, my little, you know, we would all, you know, I was obsessed with those guys. I mean, obsessed with them.
Have you met them?
I've never met Bert or Kirk. Those two guys. I worked with Anthony Quinn.
That's right.
That was a real thrill.
In Jungle Fever.
It was very, very nice. You know, I mean, with him, he was really a He was great. You know, he was. It was a thrill to work with him. It was. He told me stories about everyone. He's been in this business for 50 years, and he still is so enthusiastic and eager, and he really likes what he does. And it was great to work with him.
So you got to meet Bert now.
Oh, Bert! I know. I know he's been sick, so I wish him well. But yeah, that would be a, that'd be like a highlight to play Bert's son and imitate him. Okay, Dad. You better sit down. I am not, you know. But yeah, he's like, you know, those guys had big, you know, Cagney, Edward G, you know, and Charles Laughton too.
Charles Laughton said my very favorite quote about acting, which is, "People don't know what they're like, but I think I can show them."
Wow, that's well said. Really well said. Well, I'm going to write that down. I'm going to write. Thank you, Terry.
Hey, anytime.
Thank you very much. I'm going to put that right in my journal. Yeah, that's a good one.
So yeah. So what do you have coming up after Mac?
Well, I did two smaller roles, one in Peter Weir film, because I've been consumed with Mac, with Jeff Bridges, called Fearless, and I did a film with Bill Forsythe and Robin Williams called Being Human, which I get to play a Roman. I play the master and Robin plays the slave in one of the episodes in this film. Sort of my homage to Gore Vidal. Yes. Yeah, no, and I'm a big fan of Bill Forsythe. I really, you know, was so happy to get to work with him. I think he's a bit of a poet.
Yeah. Well, I wish you the best. I thank you so much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Actor John Turturro, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.